Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a damage assessment from the Snowden leaks as allies Germany and France express outrage over the NSA's intrusion into the private emails and cell phone calls of heads of state like Angela Merkel. A former senior CIA analyst, Paul Piller, who was the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia and head of the Assessment and Information Group at the Counterterrorist Center, joins us to discuss fallout from the continuing revelations of the NSA spying on our allies and our fellow citizens. Then we'll look into the dysfunction on Capitol Hill and the continuing influence of dark money as Senator Ted Cruz holds up the nominee to head the FCC in order to protect the anonymity of billionaire donors like the Koch brothers, who Cruz apparently feels will reciprocate by making unlimited and unaccountable donations to his 2016 presidential campaign. Lisa Gilbert, the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch and contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics, joins us to examine efforts to keep dark money and politics in the dark. Then finally, we'll get an update and an overview on the ongoing civil war in Syria, which most Americans have turned their back on as the Russian and American deal to destroy Assad's chemical arsenal goes ahead while thousands more Syrians die and millions more become refugees. We will speak with Nada Hashemi, the co-editor of the new book, The Syria Dilemma, a collection of essays from a diverse range of experts on Syria that sheds light on the many dimensions of this tragedy that is not going away. And joining us now is Paul Piller, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously, he served as Chief of Analytical Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia, and head of the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence's Counterterrorist Center. Paul Piller is currently a Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Piller.
Hello, Ian. Good to be with you.
And there was a fairly substantial demonstration today in Washington. I think it's still ongoing, against the NSA. Stop Watching Us is the name of the protest, which has drawn thousands to the nation's capital. And, of course, from other capitals around the world, particularly amongst our allies in Germany, Der Spiegel is now printing a story that then, in fact, President Obama knew in 2010 that the NSA was tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone, which had been denied. And he apparently has been on the phone doing some damage control. And earlier that, of course, we had the head of state of Brazil canceling a trip to the United States, a state visit, because of revelations from Edward Snowden's leaks that the U.S. had spied on her as well as on some big Brazilian companies. What's the logic behind that, Paul, of doing that when the downside is so great and the upside of getting information from heads of state? I mean, while we may have the capability and apparently have the capability to do that, just because we have the capability surely is not a reason to do it.
Well, of course, just having the capability to do something is not a reason to do it. I would stress that all of the downside, and I mean all of the downside, including all of the repercussions that you've reviewed, comes not from the intelligence collection activities themselves, many of which have, without question, been known to many of the parties involved. They come from the leaks, from the public revelations. It should be no surprise to most of the governments, and probably all of them concerned, that they have been the target of such activity, not only by the U.S. services like the NSA, but others as well. And there isn't an incentive for them in the normal course of business to make a protest about that. If they did so publicly or even privately in talking to U.S. officials, they would risk compromising their own counterintelligence capabilities. They would probably see this as needlessly ruffling an important relationship, namely the one with the United States, for no good purpose. It is only when something becomes public, as they have with the Snowden leaks, that any leader, whether it's Angela Merkel or anyone else, feels obliged to make a stink about it, as our own leaders would if you had a similar kind of leak dealing with the activity of someone else. So as far as what the benefit is, well, we can go on and on about just name any, you know, international negotiation which somehow involves another government, whether it's one that we consider an ally or not, or even without a specific negotiation, just in the normal course of conducting strategic, economic, political, and other business, to know or to have an additional insight into the thinking and actions and policies of foreign leaders is very valuable in numerous ways to our decision makers.
So, in other words, everybody does it to each other, and they sort of it's a sort of under the table gentleman's agreement not to talk about it, because if you do, you either expose your own capabilities or lack thereof. And I guess then if that's the case, a lot of the complaints are simply that the U.S., because of its advanced technology, just does it better. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it maybe does that part better, and what it does not better, but maybe even worse, is keep secrets. And the fact that we had someone like Snowden, who was given a clearance and did what he did, is a source of genuine and understandable concern and chagrin by our allies. Not least of all, because not only does it lead to something like we're seeing today with regard to the revelations and the repercussions that we're talking about right now, but also if you're someone in the German government or the French or the British government, you have to ask yourselves, well, if they have people like Snowden working for them, who else do they have working for them who is going to compromise secrets, perhaps to our adversaries, perhaps publicly, that involve our secrets, because, of course, we have something called intelligence liaison. We have the routine sharing of information, especially among close allies, and part of that involves the trust that the partner is going to do what is necessary to keep secrets secret, and here, clearly, the United States has failed.
So the Five Eyes program, which is where the U.S. shares its secrets with Great Britain, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, is that being compromised? Because I understand GCHQ, the British eavesdropping organization, are very upset about the Snowden leaks, which are doing what you just suggested are doing.
Well, we on the outside, of course, don't know exactly to what extent a compromise results in lessened cooperation either among those very close allies or others, but we can be assured that people in GCHQ and counterpart agencies and the other allied countries you mentioned are very upset about this sort of thing for the reason that I mentioned, that when there is extensive sharing and there is evidence of inadequate security among your partners, the first thing you have to think about is how your own secrets might be compromised. And based on my experience when I was still in the business and still being part of the intelligence community, I can recall other instances, not to be confined to the particular allies you mentioned, but again, intelligence liaison goes much more broadly than that. Other instances in which leaks back here in Washington did result in at least a temporary curtailment of cooperation from foreign partners because they were concerned and upset and alarmed by leaks here that got too close to their own secret information.
So when the Germans and the French and others say, we want this to stop and we want to join in the Five Eyes regime, in other words, they want to have preferential treatment in reciprocity where there's an agreement not to spy on each other, is that going to fly?
What we're dealing with here, Ian, is not a either-or situation where you're either in a club or you're not in it. The way this sort of intelligence liaison routinely works, not only with signals communications of the sort that NSA deals with, but also from human sources and other sources, is you have degrees of trust and intimacy, shall we say, among different pairs of partners. The way we might look at it from the U.S. point of view is concentric circles, where we have certain allies who are our closest and most trusted ones, and the ones that you mentioned earlier would certainly fall in that category. And at the far extreme, you'd have, well, you name it, you know, North Korea, say, where there's nothing but an adversary relationship. There's obviously no cooperation at all. But in between, you have many other states that are either allies but not real close allies or partners to some degree, or ones that are, you know, part of the solution and part of the problem. We have a lot of differences with them, but we also have some shared areas where the shared areas of concern and interest may lead to some sharing of information. So it's a matter of degree. And certainly everyone on the outside would like to be in those innermost circles where you get the most stuff shared with you, and there are the understandings that there is the least targeting activity against you. But it's, you know, ultimately up for us to make that decision and not for the foreign partner.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Piller, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, previously served as Chief of Analytic Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia, and headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence's Counterterrorist Center. Paul Piller is currently a professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. So I'm curious to know about, you know, nobody's much looked into the broader issues of involving the whole Snowden affair in the context of whether or not this is in fact a textbook Russian operation, given all of the evidence so far, which indicates that in many ways there are some valid questions to be asked here. And nobody, certainly I don't want to be in a situation of going against investigative journalism, because that's what I do. My job is to get as much secrets out to the public, and your previous job in the CIA was to keep hold of those secrets. So to that extent, we're on different sides. But I spoke recently with CIA Officer Bob Baer, who laid out the scenario that Edward Snowden was recruited by the Soviets or the Russians, I should say, in 2009 when Snowden worked for the CIA in Geneva. Apparently he tried to break into the Director of Operations computers, and then he basically then moved to the NSA and was able to squirrel away an enormous amount of stuff, which to this day nobody quite knows the extent and volume of what he took with him to Hong Kong, where apparently he stayed in the Russian consulate. The first political hit, the leak came out, was a presidential finding on the eve of the meeting with President Xi of China and Obama out in Palm Springs. Obama was about to beat up on the Chinese leader about cyber spying, and then lo and behold, this leak revealed a finding signed by Obama targeting China for cyber warfare. So Baer was going through the damage, of what's been done, and of course it continues to this day, and made the point that from his experience, this sure has all the hallmarks of just a traditional spying operation, where this, you know, the Russians got this guy, and the people on that are leaking the stuff are what Baer referred to as useful idiots, people that are serving to disguise the real story here, which is this is Putin laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, Ian, this is a legitimate possibility to explore, and we can be assured that there are counterintelligence types at the NSA and elsewhere who are looking into exactly these sorts of things as they assess the damage and try to make more sense out of the entire Snowden case. I'm not going to venture a bet or a guess as to what the true explanation is. I would just say that what you've described is one of the possibilities that has to be considered. Other possibilities would be that someone like Snowden was acting not, as a useful idiot tool of the Russians, but more out of some contorted sense that he was doing what was in U.S. interest, confounded with other demons floating around in his own mind about how his own role in history may play into this. I'm just not going to try to guess one way or the other. It certainly is true that when you ask the question, who benefits, the kind of question that is often asked, going back to my old counter-terrorist days, about who is the likely culprit, say, when a terrorist attack occurs, you're quite right that the Russians have had a field day with this. And as we see the additional damage dribbling out, including what we started at the beginning of our discussion with, that is to say, frictions between the United States and its West European allies, Mr. Putin and his government can only be quite happy about that. So from that standpoint, it is a thesis and a possibility that's worth exploring. Something else from my counterterrorist days, I am a little cautious and suspicious about is the whole idea of hallmarks. Often when a terrorist attack occurs, someone says, well, that has the hallmark of Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda or someone else. Whereas, in fact, it's a technique that someone else might have stumbled upon or really doesn't help you to narrow down the possibilities. So, in short, there is very much logic to what you're describing, and that is a possibility that is certainly out there. I'm not going to place a bet at this point as to whether, indeed, that's the explanation.
Well, I think one of the problems that people have with getting their heads around these possibilities is that it's possible to be both a double agent, which is certainly plenty of examples of that, and also to be a valid critic at the same time. I mean, Aldrich Ames, of course, did terrible damage, but he also, in his defense, he tried to suggest that he was motivated by his outrage about what the U.S. is doing, and that's what we understand from what we've learned about Snowden's motives. I mean, I guess the real problem here is here that, that you can't get any access to this guy to find out these things, basically, the Russians are controlling him,
That's right. And even if this was not from the beginning a Russian intelligence operation, it certainly is true. And here's where I would definitely agree with what you heard from Bob Baer, that Snowden at some point had to throw himself to the mercy of the Russians in terms of just his whereabouts, in terms of his having asylum, what he calls asylum, having a place to live in Russia. That implies a lot of things. Regardless of what his initial motives may be or how this whole escapade started, once he started looking for a place to live and that place became Russia, then he was really at the Russians' mercy. And so for him to tell the public, as he did in an interview a week or so ago, well, I didn't share anything with the Russians or with the Chinese, of course he's going to say that since he faces criminal proceedings back here in the United States if he were to ever come back here. But it's simply not believable what he said in those most recent comments, given how dependent he has made himself on the Russian government.
Well, but what Baer was pointing out was that it was a Russian leak that led the U.S. and the Western allies to ground the plane of the Bolivian president that they thought was carrying Snowden, and that was a huge embarrassment that backfired on the U.S. and it gave the Russians all the more reason to say, well, nobody else wants to take this guy; we're stuck with him. Again, that looks all too convenient.
Well, that certainly was an interesting side story to this. And again, I don't think it's conclusive evidence in terms of how this all started, but there's no question that the Russians are milking this for everything it's worth and then some. And the case of the Bolivian president's plane was one of the more striking instances of that.
So, Paul Pillar, just back to the issue of the day, the continuing fallout. You were mentioning the drip, drip, drip of all this information still coming out. My understanding is the NSA doesn't know what he's taken, that the damage assessment is incomplete. Does this mean that they have to assume the worst and literally go back and reinvent themselves, and this will cost the taxpayer additional zillions of dollars?
Typically, there is a lot of assuming the worst, or at least in a precautionary sort of way, when these damage assessments occur after some kind of leak or espionage case. That's the only prudent thing to do. And so, yes, I think there will be a lot of, at least inefficiencies and other things that don't get done that we would otherwise want to do and probably would be prudent to do for the sake of U.S. national security because of some of what has to be assumed under the worst case in terms of what's known as compromise. Yes, it is very difficult to figure out, especially given, as you pointed out earlier, that we just don't have access to this guy. Even after doing all of the electronic sleuthing that can be done, and there's a fair amount that can be done in terms of what he had poked into, whether it was in Geneva or Hawaii or wherever. But after you've done all that, you are still short of being able to say, well, this is all he stole and this is all he took. It's almost never possible to do that. And probably with Snowden, he had enough computer and electronic know-how to most likely cover a lot of his tracks. So even if the tracks aren't apparent, then some further assumptions have to be made about what he might have compromised.
Well, Paul Pillar, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Pillar, who has served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously, he served as Chief of Analytic Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He's also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence's Counterterrorist Center. Paul Pillar is currently a professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the continuing influence of dark money on Capitol Hill.
Your name is Big Brother. You say that you are watching me on the telly. See me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lisa Gilbert, the Director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Gilbert.
Thanks for having me.
And last week, there were two extraordinary stories that broke in Washington. Ted Cruz's somewhat brazen hold on the new chair of the FCC, basically trying to extract a promise out of him that he won't expose the billionaires behind television advertising in the forthcoming 2014 and 2016 elections. In other words, protecting the anonymity of billionaire donors who don't have to be attributed. And then California, the state of California, announced a settlement on dark money where they named the Koch brothers Dark Money Network, and the family that owns the Gap, the Fisher family, the clothing store, the Gap, they apparently plowed $8 million of dark money to stop a couple of propositions here in California, as did Charles Schwab's, the founder of Charles Schwab Corp. He put in $6.4 million. Philanthropist Eli Broud actually backed Governor Brown's tax increase proposal, putting in $500,000 in the opposite direction. And then you had Sheldon Adelson putting in $500,000, Crossroads GPS, Karl Rove's group put in $2 million of dark money. So dark money's alive and well, and Ted Cruz is there on Capitol Hill as a champion of it.
Yes, I think you're right to say that a lot of these stories were very interesting last week. It all came at once and just highlights the influx of secret spending that has come from major donors, that has come from corporate entities, has come from major donors backed by corporate entities, since Citizens United. And I think, the web is intricate, but when you have strong enforcement entities like California's election agency on the job, you can uncover some very interesting things. And so certainly we were happy to see Ann Ravel and the FCCP take this issue on in California and to learn in depth how much money had been spent and why.
Well, there's also another story breaking in New York where a court lifted limits on contributions to the pro-Loder Political Action Committee. And he of course, is the conservative running against Bill de Blasio, the Democrat, for the mayor of New York. So it seems to be all happening in the wrong direction, in spite of the general outrage amongst the public over the Citizens United ruling and the effects of it on our democracy, which is rapidly being captured by a handful of billionaires. How do you explain that ruling in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to flag that it's moving in the wrong direction. I think that's because we haven't yet been able to put a check on the money that we've unleashed. So ideas like what the Federal Communications Commission has that Ted Cruz is attempting to stop by putting a hold on Ted Wheeler, the nominee, are the types of ideas that will help us shine a light on all this money, but we haven't yet put into place those rules at different agencies or put into place legislation that really enables us to see what's going on. So until we do, it's not surprising that we continue to find out and hear about more scandalous money being spent in every type of race and in every state.
So since you spend your waking hours, Lisa Gilbert, as Director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, and you contribute to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics, Public Citizen, of course, is one of the few citizens lobby groups there in Washington, D.C., that is a counterweight to the enormous power of corporate money and individual money that has been unleashed because of the Citizens United decision. Give us your sense on, here we are sort of trying to do an overview of where we stand and what people can do about this situation, and you're fighting the good fight. So give us your overview of where we stand and what we can do.
Sure. Well, certainly you've highlighted a number of specific cases that have occurred due to the influx of secret and corporate money into our system in the last several years, and then, prior to that as well. I think, we're in an interesting position because this Congress, the Congress that brought us the debt ceiling crisis, the sequester, et cetera, came into office via the two most expensive congressional elections in history based on the influx of money. And so they are very rigid ideologically. And so that has led us to a situation where it's quite hard to pass solutions at the congressional level to deal with the money. So that's, from my vantage as someone who watches Congress, our organization or our division is, of course, called Congress Watch. We see that every day play out in numerous different fights. So what that has led us to think are the real solutions to Citizens United in the short term, at least around disclosure, are both efforts like what happened at the state level. Again, California's great victory, the Fair Political Practices Commission, really tracking the dark money and figuring out that it was being, you know, basically money laundered through different organizations. So those types of state solutions are critical. And then also things that different agencies can do, so sort of not depending on Congress, are also critical. One thing that we focused on quite a lot that we hope to see come to pass is the Securities and Exchange Commission. They have the authority to mandate disclosure at publicly traded companies of their political spending. You know, not only is that important for democracy, but it's also important for the investors and companies to know how their money is being spent, so they can make smart decisions around their investments. And so it certainly fits within the SEC's mandate and authority to put a rule into place to, you know, seek disclosure. And we hope it happens, because that, you know, that's the first piece of this puzzle, just being able to track the money and thinking about disclosure. I think beyond that, you know, we don't think disclosure is the whole solution. It's just the first step to understanding where the money is going and why. From there, we're looking for more long-term solutions like public financing, both at the state level, and then once we have some congressional changes here federally, and then, of course, also at the state level, the push to just overturn Citizens United completely via constitutional amendment is alive and well, and states are, you know, in an ongoing way, supporting resolutions to overturn Citizens United, and we need that momentum to continue as well.
So there are two important federal commissions then that could make a difference, and that's why Ted Cruz is blocking the FCC. The FCC has the authority to force the television companies, when they take these television ads, which are the main source through which Americans get their political information in campaigns, to attribute where the money is coming from, in the way that they put a little banner at the bottom, you know, instead of the candidate saying, you know, I'm Ted Cruz and I support, you know, endorse this advertisement or whatever they mandated to say. It would also say, you know, brought to you by ExxonMobil and Koch Industries. He's trying to stop that. And the SEC also has the authority to mandate that corporations who put money into politics, they be identified as well for the benefit of their shareholders, I take it. So we know that Ted Cruz is blocking the former. Who's blocking the latter?
Actually, right now we have a lot of hope for the latter. So you asked, you know, what people can do, and I think that's an arena that folks should think about. Certainly we have a new SEC chair who is, you know, incredibly competent and come into place as this rule to require disclosure. The SEC had decided to consider proposing it, and she, you know, took office right after that happened. And so, you know, we hope that she'll continue to move the rule forward. You know, the reason that it was sort of placed on the Securities and Exchange Commission's agenda is that so many, many investors spoke out and said they wanted it. And this is not just sort of big mutual fund type investors, but individual retail investors like all of us. You know, most people have a 401k or some sort of pension, and that money is being invested in these corporate entities that are spending it in politics. You know, it's kind of horrible to think of, you know, spending your $25 to support a candidate and then not knowing that your entire pension is going to oppose that same candidate. So, you know, people are outraged about that and spoke out and told the Securities and Exchange Commission to create this rule. And it's made a difference. And so, you know, we're hopeful. And I think what people can do is continue to tell the SEC that they want this rulemaking, and comment and share that it's important to them.
Well, Lisa Gilbert, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Gilbert, who's the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics, and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Syria dilemma.
It's the money.
اكتب بخط بالقلم
أكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس ما لي حدا يا ناس ما لي حدا بهمي وعسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy Towards Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-authored with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
And let's start with the first issue, and that is what came up in a recent, or a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed the former CIA officer, Bob Baer, who'd spent a lot of time in Syria and Lebanon, and he stays in touch with the Alawite officers and intelligence people he's known over the years. And he's pretty much convinced that the chemical attack was in response or in retaliation to the slaughter of a bunch of Alawite villages that are very close to where the Assads were born, their natal village. And it was really just a simple, straightforward kind of tribal tit-for-tat, if you will, that on the 19th of August, the Syrian army finally retook these villages that the al-Nusra and other jihadi groups in the Syrian opposition had taken and had slaughtered everybody in a very graphic and provocative way. And the Alawite community was so outraged that they basically forced the regime, whose job it is to protect them, to up the ante, and that's why a couple of days later they used chemical weapons. Do you buy that theory?
You know, I haven't investigated it. This is actually the first I'm hearing it. I haven't read Bob Baer's sort of reports on this. Even if it were true, the use of chemical weapons is widely viewed in the international community as a banned weapon, as a weapon of mass destruction, and it clearly implicates the Assad regime in engaging in a war crime, if not a crime against humanity, on a colossal scale that can't be compared with, you know, tit-for-tat sort of sectarian clashes that have been taking place in Syria over the past 2 years. So if this is an attempt to somehow try and justify the use of chemical weapons, and we now know this is not the first time the Assad regime has used chemical weapons, I think it's a very pathetic justification. If we were to believe the American intelligence reports, you know, on one day, in less than a day, in less than an hour, 1,500 civilians were killed, 426 children were gassed with sarin gas. So I don't think, you know, these reports, assuming that they are true, can any way sort of justify not only the use of chemical weapons, but I think if one looks at the overwhelming bigger picture of what's happening in Syria, we have, you know, a one-family dynasty that's been in power for 43 years that has killed over 100,000 people, overwhelmingly civilians, and we have the worst humanitarian crisis of the 20th century unfolding before our eyes, and most of the responsibility for this particular crisis can be laid at the doorstep of the Assad regime and its attempt to hold on to power. So I think we shouldn't sort of let little stories that emerge somehow blind us from the bigger reality that has been unfolding before our eyes, and that's that compromises and constitutes the tragedy of Syria today.
Well, indeed, I don't think anybody's suggesting that this is any way a justification for what the Assads did. It's more of a question of answering the question, or at least filling in the gap, that this is not a completely insane, psychotic regime that's totally motivated by irrational evil, that they didn't wake up one day and said, let's use chemical weapons because, you know, we're just evil people. They did it because there was a reason within their very, very obviously unpleasant frame of mind. And it's true, it's a family plantation. They've owned this country, right, and they really believe that they have a divine right to rule.
Right. But no, you know what? I mean, the story in and of itself, assuming it's true, does provide a possible theory or explanation as to why Assad used chemical weapons, because, you know, one of the immediate sort of debates that ensued in the aftermath is, you know, why would the Assad regime do this given the consequences that could flow from it? It didn't seem rational. I agree this is a regime that is rational. It's not sort of psychotic in the sense that it doesn't want to commit sort of suicide. It is trying to preserve its power, and it's doing everything it can to perpetuate its rule. So, you know, the story does in and of itself sort of possibly assuming that if it's true, does perhaps provide some context as to why they decided to drop chemical weapons on a suburb of Damascus. But so, I mean, that's an interesting conversation to pursue.
Sure.
The point that I'm concerned about is that we shouldn't lose sight of the larger picture of what's been taking place in Syria and the broader political context in terms of how the Syrian revolution began and how it's unfolded and what the international community could or should be doing at this moment.
Well, in that regard, Nat Hashemi, I think there is a connection in as much as the deal, the Russian-American deal, and there's some evidence that the whole deal was prompted in when Secretary of State John Kerry made his off-the-cuff remark at the press conference in London when asked, is there any way we can avoid bombing, or the Syrian regime can avoid being bombed by the U.S. because of the chemical weapons use? Kerry sort of offhandedly said, well, you know, if they got rid of all their chemical weapons in a week, but they're not going to do that. And apparently the Iranians seized on that and managed to lean on the Assad regime to take the deal. The Iranians didn't want to take credit for it because they recognized their sort of political kryptonite and allowed the Russians to take the lead. That's my understanding. Is that your understanding?
That is my basic understanding. I mean, there's a convergence of opinion among all of the key players, the United States, the Assad regime, the Russians, and the Iranians. They all agree that they don't want to see any further external intervention taking place. And so in many ways, the proposal that was made to sort of remove the chemical weapons out of Syria in exchange for the United States, you know, committing itself not to engage in military strikes satisfied all of the key parties. And, of course, you know, many people were celebrating this as a huge step forward, but, of course, it is a huge distraction, and it fundamentally, you know, doesn't solve the underlying problems of Syria. And in fact, if one looks at the casualty figures since the use of chemical weapons on the 21st of August of this year, approximately 3,000, if not more, Syrians have been killed. We're talking about within the last, you know, couple of months, in 2 months only. So the killing continues. And so the chemical weapons, I think, agreement is not to be celebrated. It satisfies the interests of many of the key players, but it certainly doesn't satisfy the interests of the vast majority of the Syrian people who continue to suffer under this brutal regime. But it is important to point out here, and I think there is some lessons to be learned, that we got this chemical agreement to the extent that one wants to sort of consider it a victory. This chemical weapons agreement only happened and could only have happened with the credible threat of force that the United States was directing at the Assad regime. Had that not happened, they would not have capitulated. And so I think there's broader lessons there in terms of what needs to happen to promote a political settlement in this part of the world. Simply sort of wishing it to happen or hoping that the parties can come to a negotiating table in Geneva and everyone will agree and the Assad regime will sort of willfully and openly negotiate its own exit from power is, you know, wishful thinking at best.
Again, I'm speaking with Nat Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Kobil School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory of Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-authored with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. So the deal, which is being celebrated, of course, allows the Assads to stay in power. And I think when you say that the only reason it happened was that there was a credible threat of force, that sort of flies in the face of much of the opposition at the time. And you know that the president was responding, I think, in part to the Congress and to the polls that indicated the American people are overwhelmingly against another war in the Middle East. But it would seem to me that given the reaction by the Saudis and by the Turks, that they're very upset with the United States for not taking out Assad. And the fact that Assad took the deal that the Iranians suggested he take was he knew that he was avoiding, I think, regime change, was he not? I mean, do you think that when had the U.S. gone ahead and struck Syria, it wouldn't have been a pinprick?
Well, the United States was claiming at the time that it would just be a limited strike and it was just simply meant to send a message. And I think that in and of itself really sent had a chilling effect on the Assad regime. They wanted to do everything that they could to avoid any sort of military strike that could have sort of inspired the opposition forces, that could have weakened the Assad regime. Assad did everything in his power to avoid that particular option and you know, very revealingly conceded and turned over his entire chemical weapons arsenal, a chemical weapons arsenal, by the way, which, you know, the previous day he claimed that he didn't have and he didn't use. And so I think that was, I think, the motive for the Assad regime to sort of capitulate on this particular issue, because he really felt that this could possibly be a game changer, even if it was a limited strike. If you talk to sort of many people in the Syrian opposition, they are deeply upset that the military strike didn't take place, because they thought that even if it was a limited one, it would still have shaken the Assad regime. It could have led to more defections. It would have at least had a psychologically emboldening effect on the opposition forces, that the balance of power on the ground perhaps is starting to shift. So I think those are the calculations that were taking place at that time. But of course, now we are at a different moment. It's widely viewed and it's now acknowledged and I think accepted. The Syrian National Coalition accepts the fact and has acknowledged the fact that there is going to be no external assistance of a significant degree that can tip the balance of power on the ground in their benefit, and so they're going to have to make a decision as to whether they want to go to the negotiating table, go to the Geneva conference next month, and try and get the best deal possible. So those are sort of some of the, I think, perspectives that were out there with respect to the events that that were related to the use of chemical weapons and the consequences of a possible military strike in the aftermath of the use of those weapons.
And Nada Hashemi, your book, The Syria Dilemma, is a compilation of all of the leading scholars on Syria and the leading analysts. So it provides an overview of all of the very complexities of this struggle. And the latest complexity, of course, is that the Kurdish Peshmerga militia are now at war with the al-Nusra, the jihadis who taken over that rebel area of the Kurdish area of Syria that borders on Turkey and Iraq, and that's led to a fairly severe battle that's going on as we speak. So there's another dimension that the al-Nusra people, the jihadis, have put out a fatwa against Kurds as heretics, and right. So they're at war. So there's many layers to this.
The longer the conflict drags on, the more complicated and messy it gets, the more there are internal sort of conflicts and squabbles between the forces that mobilized to oppose the Assad regime. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. I see the longer that this thing drags on, the more you're going to see these type of intersectarian, ideological sort of clashes in Syria that sort of, you know, just highlight how tragic this conflict has become. It initially was, for the first, you know, 6 to 8 months, an overwhelmingly peaceful, nonviolent, democratic and non-sectarian uprising. I think we should not forget, you know, the origins of this conflict. And there really were two sides. There was the Assad regime, and then there was the nonviolent opposition that spontaneously emerged in the context of the Arab Spring. But as a consequence of the repression of the regime, crushing those revolts, and also critically, and it's important, I think, for your listeners to appreciate this fact, largely because the international community, in particular, large parts of the North American and European left, because they abandoned the Syrian revolution, they really didn't have much to say, they really didn't have much interest, they didn't get involved when they could have gotten involved, the conflict is now sort of degenerated to this particular level, and my prediction is it's only going to get worse.
So why do you think the European and American left abandoned the Syrian opposition, who were initially nonviolent and were being slaughtered in the streets for protesting against this dictatorship that's, you know, been there for over 40 years, and a very brutal and pervasive dictatorship run by ubiquitous Muhabarat, the secret police? on the one hand, these are the same people that celebrated Tahrir Square and the revolution in Egypt, but somehow turned their back on the Syrians. What's your explanation for that?
Well, of course, I think one has to be fair. There's not sort of one American left or European left. There are different sort of strands and perspectives within that movement. I mean, the extreme elements of the American and European left, some of them sort of had a certain sympathy and empathy toward Assad because he allegedly sort of was part of this axis of resistance against American and Israeli policy. And so those elements of the left really didn't care about having that regime, that so-called axis of resistance, weakened. But I think the broad mainstream of the left, unfortunately, has a very American-centric view of the world, and by extension, if I can say this, and also a very narcissistic view of the world. In other words, they view the entire world through the prism of their own particular internal debates here in the United States and their own opposition, much of it very legitimate to sort of U.S. foreign policy globally. And so my reading of the left's reaction or lack of action with respect to the uprising in Syria is because, you know, the United States really didn't get involved at the beginning of the uprising. It sort of made statements. And the broad position of the American left tends to be they tend to sit on their rear ends and they wait and see what position the United States is going to take. And then they make a 180-degree turn and they adopt the opposite position. And I think, you know, we've seen that manifest itself in many different ways. And so because the United States wasn't directly involved, and if you look at the debates, there was all this discussion about the U.S. role in Syria and the U.S. sort of getting involved in sort of, you know, arming some elements of the rebel opposition. And the truth was that the United States really never got involved in any serious or significant way. The most that was sent were sort of non-lethal, sort of small arms at best, and that was sort of a drop in a bucket in terms of the balance of power on the ground. But the primary intervening forces, if one wants to talk about the problem of foreign intervention in Syria, was Iranian, Russian, and Hezbollah intervention. And, of course, that doesn't concern the American left because the American left is only concerned about U.S. intervention. And there are times when I think it's appropriate to be concerned about U.S. intervention. But what do you do in a case like Syria when the primary intervening countries and entities are not the United States or its allies, and they are committing atrocities that are borderline genocidal? And so the left really doesn't have, I think, a coherent ideological position. So they really didn't get involved in Syria, and they don't really care. And if you look at a lot of the narratives and the discussions and the debates, there's a lot of sort of confusion over how to respond. The role that the United States is playing is elevated and exaggerated, and that of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, and particularly the Assad regime, is diminished in the moral narratives and in the political interpretations of the Syrian conflict. And we've seen this time and time again. I mean, I see a lot of parallels and echoes to what happened in Bosnia and in Kosovo, where the American left adopted a very similar position: no interest in commenting or getting involved and coming to the rescue of the people of Bosnia when they were facing a genocidal sort of Serbian nationalist intervention that destroyed that country. But as soon as the United States sort of got involved, then there were howls of outrage and opposition toward the United States in ways that I think really don't stand up to critical or moral scrutiny.
Well, just in the last minute or so here, Nader Hashemi, let's turn to the fact that we have these strange alliances in effect between Israel and Saudi Arabia. They're both angry at the United States, as is Turkey, for not intervening. A senior Israeli diplomat said the United States did a lot of damage to their image by failing to attack Syria. We know the Turks are annoyed and the Saudis are furious, and they're talking about maybe changing their whole political orientation because they're also angry at the way the United States allowed Mubarak to fall, as are the Israelis, and both the Saudis and the Israelis are supporting this military coup in Egypt. So you have some strange bedfellows there. Just give us your analysis on those changing, you know, the fact that I think in the vacuum that you're talking about of U.S. intervention, the Saudis are going to probably up their ante, which will need more jihadis on the rebel side, which of course plays right into Assad's hands.
Well, on that last point, I think we have to be careful. The Saudi intervention in Syria has not been supporting the extremist jihadi elements. In fact, the Saudi and Qatari intervention have been supporting some of the more moderate elements. The jihadi presence and the al-Qaeda presence in Syria is getting support and sustenance from private charities in the Gulf. So one has to make that distinction. There was a big piece in the New York Times just a couple of days on this, where the Saudis are actually very wary and very fearful of arming sort of different groups in Syria out of fear of a repetition of what happened in Afghanistan, that these rebel groups will then come back and sort of cause problems for the Saudi ruling family. So I think that's a point that I think hasn't been clarified. And there's actually an essay in our book by Thomas Pierret. I think it's the last essay in our book that actually goes into some description as to how this is playing itself out. But broadly speaking, with respect to your question, I think, you know, you have all the major players in the region, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, they're all pursuing their own national interests. And there's some overlap in terms of their national interests converging with respect to Syria and wanting to see the Assad regime toppled and wanting to see the United States get involved militarily. But I think it's important to point out that there's not a unified strategy here. There's a convergence of interest. The Israelis have their own reasons for wanting to see the United States involved militarily. That's largely because of their obsession with Iran. The Saudis have, you know, their own agenda that they're pursuing, and that has to do with their fear of Iranian hegemony in the Middle East and hoping to sort of topple an ally of Iran so that Saudi Arabia can expand its influence. It has no interest in democracy or democratization. The Turks have their own sort of agenda. So there's really sort of separate, you know, nationalist, I think, agendas that are being pursued by the ruling elites of all of these countries. They happen to all converge, and it just, you know, creates a very complex and difficult situation for outside observers. But, of course, the biggest losers in all of this is now Syria has become a battleground for all of these regional agendas. And the biggest losers, of course, are the Syrian people who really began an uprising without any interest in resolving these regional debates. They simply wanted to topple a brutal 43-year one-family dictatorship and try and promote a political transition toward democracy so they could have a decent sort of chance at a reasonable future and a decent life. But because of the conflict has dragged on, because of where Syria is located, because of these regional international rivalries, we have this, you know, very chaotic situation that has unfolded, and it's, in my prediction, is going to continue for a very long time to come.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-edited with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rushert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.